station at Cape Canaveral in the space program. And we were having an officer's dining in, and our guest speaker for the day was Benjamin Floyd. At the time, he was 92 years old. He was the oldest living Air Force officer. He had personally flown Wright Brothers number one. That really startled me. You know, I was kind of awed that I'd had the privilege to meet this man. He said that the Army Signal Corps bought Wright Brothers number one. They disassembled it and hauled it to Langley Field, Virginia from North Carolina, put it back together, and he was a brand new second lieutenant, and they gave him a set of written orders commanding him to learn how to fly it. They gave him a buck sergeant, three stripe, who was an engine mechanic, and they gave him a corporal as a flunky. So that was a three-man team, and that was the U.S. Air Force at the time. With one airplane, an old biplane, he had talked to the Wright brothers prior to disassembling it, and they described what do you do when you fly an airplane. So after he got it put together, the sergeant got the engine started. He climbed in the little slat seat up front, maneuvered the stick, moved the rudder pedals to see that they were operational. He strapped himself in, added power, took off, and promptly crashed. So he sat down and wrote the Wright brothers. He said, "Dear sirs, I did thus and so, and it crashed." Well, they wrote back, said, "Dear Lieutenant Floyd, if you do that, it'll crash every time." Said, "Here's what you should have done." So, you know, it was no trouble to rebuild it. It wasn't built out of anything to start with. So they rebuilt it, and the mechanic got the engine going again. And we repeated the process, and down the runway took off and flew a little longer this time, but it crashed again. He sat down and wrote, "Dear sirs, I did thus and so, and it crashed." They said, "Well, if you do that, it'll crash every time." So three times this happened, and three times he crashed, and then for the rest of his flying career, he never had another crash. He claimed to be the world's first correspondence pilot. He learned by correspondence how to fly. But he did fly a variety of other aircraft after that time. He said the instrument panel was fairly simple, that he devised that himself. He took a piece of baling wire and stretched it between the retainers for the rudder pedals and tied a red ribbon on it. If the ribbon's fluttering, he's moving. And if the ribbon's fluttering fast, then he's going kind of fast. If the ribbon's up, he's in a dive. If the ribbon's down, he's in a climb. And then he said, "Lord, help me if it's going the other way." Well, so he was a leader in the U.S. Air Force. Years ago, I was privileged to be in the first all-student jet class that the Air Force had. We had had a lot of propeller students go through, but we the oldest airplane on the flight line where I learned to fly in Selma, Alabama, had 6 hours on it. In other words, it had just been rolled out of the factory. I didn't really have a lot of encouragement. My crew chief was out there with a technical manual trying to figure out how to start it. I said, "I have lost confidence in this program." If they'd have said, "All you country boys who want to go home, you can bail out now." Man, they'd have got trampled in the door. I wasn't the only one who felt that way. Well, leadership takes a variety of forms. The military obviously tries to produce leaders. At the Air Force Academy, send me men, implying men leaders. They spend lots of time at the Academy working on leadership. In fact, some of you know Bob Linden, Colonel Linden, retired. He taught leadership at the Air Force Academy for a while. I'm privileged to have just a delightful young man in our family now, married my second daughter. He's a graduate of the Academy. They spent lots of time on leadership. I think the LDI, Leadership Development Institute, I think it's a very vital subject. I probably would like to take a bit of a different perspective this morning. First, in the beginning, let me just ask you a few questions. If you were to, biblically, if you were to bring up at least one or two key principles from the Bible that you feel are key characteristics for leaders, what one or two would you mention? Nehemiah. Okay, as a passage. Now, what characteristics?
Initiative.
Okay, something else? Integrity. What about Nehemiah? Was there something specific maybe that triggers your mind about Nehemiah?
Single-minded.
He had an objective and he stuck to it, no matter what.
Man of prayer.
Any other ideas?
Intuitiveness.
It's what? Intuitiveness?
No, I said stick-to-itiveness.
Stick-to-itiveness. Okay. All right, stick in there. Don't give up. That's what I'm having to do now. Somebody asked me yesterday, how are you doing, man? I'm hanging in there. One day at a time. But I think that's what we all need to do. If you get too far lost in the future or too much snowed with the past, you're going to bum out. You're not going to live in the future. You're not going to take care of what God gives you for today. Another characteristic or two, biblically, that comes to mind.
Servant.
Is that a nice thing to be?
If you don't get treated like
one. As long as you don't get treated like one. Do you think that servanthood in America is looked upon with admiration?
No.
No, I really don't think so either. And yet in Matthew 20, it's listed as a requirement, isn't it? If you really want to be a leader, you have to serve. If you want to be chief among the leaders, what do you have to be?
A slave.
I mean, really subject to others, and that is not kosher in America today, is it? To serve. To be a servant. Okay, any other characteristic you'd like to bring up? Okay. Anything else? Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Was that confidence for Joshua?
Joshua was to exhibit confidence, a lack of fear, a lack of discouragement, because he knew God was with him.
That's right. He knew that God was with him. What did other people know?
That he was being directed by
him. That God, they knew that God was with him. Boy, what can you tell in a case like that? I told a fellow the other day, I said, some others had not recognized certain things in his life. I said, you know my position in that? I don't care what anybody else thinks. I've made up my own mind about this. I said, I have observed that God's hand is on your life. I'm impressed. What limitations are there if God's hand's on the life? There aren't any, are they? Suppose he doesn't match my model. Well, you know, it doesn't matter, does it? If we can tell that God's hand is on his life. Well, I think characteristics, we could go on and name some more. Characteristics of leadership has been an approach that's been used over the years. However, research has shown that it's not a dependable concept. And let me explain why. You see, there are some men who've been very, very staunch leaders who were not that way, who didn't have all these characteristics. As example, what about David with Bathsheba? He was a murderer and an adulterer. Does that sound like integrity to you? And honesty, was God's hand on his life when he was committing those sins? No. But what did God say about him? Yes, sir. I found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who shall fulfill all my will. Boy, I think God explained why David was a man after his own heart. He was going to do what God told him to do. God would say, do it, and he said, yes, sir. You know, and there's no discussion and no malingering about that. He got right on with it. Now, another reason that the theory may not be that substantial to carry through, just saying the characteristics, is that there have been men and people, men and women, who've had quite a number of these characteristics in their lives. And by observation, they appeared not to be that strong of a leader. Have you seen that? When you really analyze the character, the personality traits, they were honest, they were mature, they were sincere, they had an objective, they stuck to what they were about, but people didn't seem to follow them. I guess if I had to put a bottom line on leadership, it's really this question. Is anyone following? Now that's overly simplified, but I've spent a lot of time looking at these, and every leadership, every definition of leadership I've ever seen has holes in it. And this one obviously does. It's far, far oversimplified. But I think the bottom line is, in a given circumstance, is anyone following? If they are, then I would suggest you are a leader. If they're not following, then I suggest in that situation you're not a leader. Now, of what causes people to follow? I think it's some of the characteristics that we mentioned. They're certainly involved. Did you know that as I listened to you, I didn't find a single person who says one of the key requirements to be an effective leader is not lord it over anyone? Did you know I didn't hear that from anybody this morning? Do you know who I hear that from? Nobody. I don't hear it from anyone. Oh, at times I'll hear a little description, but they're really not talking about leadership. They're talking about something that collapsed, some circumstance, and that one of the key reasons was that the leader tried to over-dominate it and probably lost his job in the final analysis. Now, it's all introduction. I mean, we're down to the subject now. Styles of leadership. We're going to look at four styles. It's a business film, and it has a secular ring to it, but I think we can learn some, make some observations from the film. The film is almost as old as I am. If we could wait another 3 or 4 years, it won't look that old. The lapels are very thin. Well, we're almost back to thin lapels again. Ties are very thin. Well, that's thinner than the one I wore 2 years ago. Of course, some of us never could do anything about the hair problem. But the hair is cut kind of short. So if you can get by that, I think the circumstance is appropriate for today. It's a role-playing film. And in that film, we're going to see four styles of leadership. We're going to see a man who tells. And you might call him an authoritarian or dictatorial, whatever words you want to put. He's not really asking their permission for anything. He's telling them. Then there's a man we might call sells. He tries to sell people in going along with his idea. Very honestly, he is a teller at heart, but he likes to use this other technique to try to persuade them. The final analysis, he's going to have his way. It's not really a group decision about anything. And he might manipulate, he might do most anything, play one person against another in order to sell his idea. The positive end of that would be motivating, meaning if you can offer some motivational ideas, then that's an appropriate thing to do in selling, is to give motivation. But the seller basically is a teller at heart that's using another technique. Then we got a fellow, you might call him consults. He's a participative type leader. He gets other people to offer their ideas, and he's open to listen. He will make the final decision, but he's open to listen. And he's willing to change his mind. Are you willing to change your mind? I'm working at that still. And the lead-off statement is something like this. I've considered what you've said, and I've decided to change my mind. How's that? Am I willing to change my mind? I am positively making a statement that says I am changing my mind. That's hard to do, especially if you bent toward the authoritarian end. Very, very difficult for an authoritarian to say, I've changed my mind. Then there was a fourth style called joins. Some people call that the laissez-faire approach, to let it alone. But the joins is a pretty good idea. The leader becomes one of the group. He joins the group. So we've got four styles. Now there are more. And we might talk a little bit about some of the other types of leadership and approach to leadership when we've concluded with the film. But that's the preview that we'll give. We'll see a business setting in which a man has a decision to make. And he's thinking, what's the best approach to use with the people who work for me in making this decision? He doesn't know how to approach it, what style of leadership to use. And then he fades back into his memory to some old bosses that he had years in the past. And then we see four different situations, four different role-playing situations, and what goes on. It'd be the same problem and the same staff people, but a different leader every time. If some of you are in the leadership training, that's an interesting situation to give a live problem or as near a real problem as you can. And get a staff together and then rotate leaders. Don't let the first leader see what they... In other words, if you had three or four you wanted to check out, just to see how they're doing. Put a new leader in the same circumstance with the same people. I've done that a number of times, a similar situation. I put that on videotape. It's quite enlightening. And to play it back, you know, for everybody to see and to hear. Well, you say, that's threatening. Yeah, it is. It really is a threatening situation. I admit that. Well, let's see. I got distracted. Four styles of leadership. Now, the Bible speaks very little about, quote, styles of leadership. Have you noticed that? Did you ever see in the Bible to exercise this style of leadership, a statement like that? I never did. So if the Bible doesn't speak about a thing, there may be considerable freedom in dealing with it, as long as it's not precluded. However, there's one style of leadership that's precluded. We were just talking about Matthew 20. And Jesus, you know, there had been a request made, two brothers, one to be on the right hand, one to be on the left hand. And Jesus is talking about this position. He says, you know, the Gentiles lord it over one another, but that's not the way it's supposed to be with you. Now, that's my translation of it. That's not the quote. And he goes on to tell you you're to serve and to be a slave. And then in 1 Peter 5, the first three or four verses, Peter is writing to elders, leaders, church leaders, and he says, not lording it over anyone, but but examples to the flock. Unger has taken extensive time to explain what that means from the Greek. And one statement he made really impressed me. He said that means that the authoritarian domination of a person's life by another person is not permitted. So I have to conclude that the Bible says very little about styles of leadership, but one that's spoken prominently about that is denied, and that is authoritarian domination of one person's life by another person. God is to be in complete control of each of our lives, and I have seen it taught from God to my leader to me, and I refuse to allow that to stand in my life. I like the idea that says from God to my leader as one point, maybe in a triangle, and then I've got my personal line to God, my conscience and my accountability, so then every one of us shall give account of himself to God. Now, I've got a voluntary leadership line, but it is not inserting a man between God and me. You see the difference? That I have a voluntary line to my leader. I am willingly subject to my leader. And he has willingly taken the leadership role. Well, I had an interchange with my boss just this week, Jack Mayhall. And it was a delightful interchange. He was being loving and considerate of a personal problem I'm involved in right now. And it really, really did stir my heart. He's available to me for any kind of a problem, and I'm willingly subject to him. But you see, that's not inserting him between God and me. Now, I don't know if you might have heard that taught differently. I don't believe the Bible teaches that I'm supposed to allow anybody to be inserted between God and me, that I have accountability directly to God, no matter what. So then every one of us should give account of himself to God, whether I like it or not, or whether my leader agrees, or whether the navigator stand or fall. I have a direct responsibility to God. Now, if God has appointed my leader, and I'm assuming that he has, I've accepted that without question, that Jack Mayhall is my leader. And Lawrence Sand is my leader. And I am willingly subject to them, but they're not trying to insert themselves between God and me. You know how I know this? One of the key ways is when we were invited to come out here, Lawrence Sand said, Bill, how are you coming with your guidance to come out to the Glen? I said, well, Lauren, it looks like we're probably to come. I would say we have about 95% peace. He says, don't come yet. He says, don't come yet until it's right between God and me. How do you like that? Does that sound right to you? Is that inserting himself between God and me? No, he has I think it's a different relationship. I really probably like a circular relationship as opposed to triangular. If I were going to draw it, I'd probably draw a series of circles and tie those circles together from a leadership standpoint, not that authoritarian thing that we so quickly put, my leader, a direct line down to me, because there are other things going on that preclude this dominating thing. And if you draw your organization chart to be authoritarian, then you can expect that's probably going to occur at some point in time. Well, I'm preaching. Did you know that? I'm not teaching right there. I'm preaching because I think we have paid an inordinate price, some of us, for sustaining an illegitimate leadership style. I have to conclude it's illegitimate if God said don't do it. Now, somebody said, yes, sir.
Bill, would there be a difference between an autocratic style leadership and an authoritarian dominated style?
Well, no, they're not the same. I might be autocratic in a certain circumstance, but I'm really describing a heart attitude, that if I have in my heart that I'm an authoritative dominator, that means I want to control people rather than looking to God to do it. Now, we're going to look at four styles, one of which is a teller, which is, it has an authoritarian type view, but there are times when we need that style of leadership. We want to talk about that. I'm talking about a heart function now. Is my heart such that I want to control instead of God? Do you see the problem? Then I dominate other people's life, but I don't give them the option to respond according to their conscience before God. But there are obviously times when we're going to need an authoritative view if I happen to be an authority in something. Then it may be that gives me a function. You talk, somebody who knows what they're doing, single-minded, this initiative and all those things, if I qualify, that might be a time. I can give you a personal instance in which I was authoritative. I was a band director, among other things. And we just didn't vote about the music we were going to play. If they had a request, I would listen to it. And then when it came to the phrasing, you know, and the timing, we didn't have heavy discussions about that. I took the authority. I was the authority, and I decided. I listened, but I made the decision. And we can't have everybody doing their own thing in the band. So there are other times. We'll probably need to talk about them after we've seen the style and go back and consider them one at a time. Because there are times when this style of leadership is an appropriate one, but not the heart attitude that says, I want to dominate somebody else's life. And not lording it over somebody. Do you see the difference? I may be an authority, and I may have to lead in a very positive way, and there may not be time to ask anybody else's viewpoint. But even then, I'm not having a heart's desire that says, I want to control somebody's life. You don't hear that a lot, do you? Well, I wanted to make that point because I think we've paid heavy prices over the years. You know how I've concluded that? I travel around much of the world, and I'm not in the authority line. The organization chart's got kind of a horizontal line out here for me. So I'm unthreatening. I don't threaten anyone. And people can be very honest with me, and I found out that we're paying a heavy price for persistence on not listening. You know, one of the key phrases that trigger off the authoritative dominator, that the follower says, he won't listen. He won't listen to anything I say. Now, we want to talk in a few minutes about some more of these things. Tell you what I'd like to do now. Let me give, would you please see that every one of us get a copy of that? I've got a handout that summarizes these four styles. Now, as I recall in the film, they may not take them in the same order that they're presented on here. To me, this is a logic order from the control to no control, starting with the teller has strong control and the joiner has very little control. So that's the order in which I listed them. I've got a description of some ideas that are brought up in the film for your consideration. So what we'll do next then is we'll turn the film on and we'll see this film through. And then we'll have a discussion about each of the styles after that. So I think probably step one is we'll get the lights turned down a bit. And then we'll turn the film on. I left the sound on, but it's not turned up.
Am I reading you off? Well, Mr. Demeter is pretty far away from Mr. Austin, isn't he? Here, the group joins the leader in making the decision. And this time, there was a high degree of acceptance on the part of the men. It's interesting to note that with this style of leadership, The group is also more concerned about the effect the decision has on their subordinates. So, Jim has another alternative. He can let the men join him in making the decision.
This contract will have far-reaching effects on our company and the people. That's why I think we should try and do a careful job of considering all the angles and try and come up with a decision that makes sense to all of us, or at least most of us. If I do that, at least they would have to take responsibility for it. If they have the knowledge and experience to make the right decision, do they really want the same things the company wants? If I had the time to get everyone involved, get them on the phone. And the big question, would I want to go along with a decision I didn't believe in? That's something my next boss, Mr. Manning, would have found a way around. He probably would have begun with individuals, not the whole group.
Pete, I called you off the line because I have something important to discuss with you. You're the key man in this. The company has developed a contract. It runs for a period of 3 months. If we accept it, we'll have to do it in addition to our regular work.
You mean it involves stepping up our production schedule?
I'm afraid so.
Oh, brother.
Can we do it?
Not a lot of horses for everybody.
The company needs this contract to push it, and has a lot of budget for it. So when the job is completed, there'll be a little staff for your office. Say, a fourth of your salary for the period of the contract.
That's fine. I may need a little special cooperation from a couple of my top operators.
Okay. Let them earn a little overtime. Now, if that's not enough for them to justify it, give them a little time off. But only after the job is over. It's the only way I can justify it.
I don't know whether this will help you or not, but Jim's got a couple of machines which I think will be a little special rigging. Might hold up for 3 months.
Thanks. Where would we get the men to operate them?
Carl's department. He's got a couple of men who are anxious for a back line job and the extra pay.
Oh, I see. Move them up and throw a couple of jewelers to the bottom. Excellent idea. But why don't I call a conference on this for this afternoon, say about 3 o'clock? And you can present your idea to Carl and Jim. I have a feeling that Jim may be just a little sticky on this.
I think I know just what to bring around. Mr. Manning feels it's important to have his people accept his decision voluntarily. Accordingly, more than Jim's previous bosses, Mr. Manning knows his men and what is likely to influence each. He uses this knowledge to bargain and maneuver to get compliance. The men quickly follow his example and bargain with him and with each other.
I'll go work on Carl in the meantime.
Mr. Mendoza, likewise.
Thanks, Pete. I love a lot. I do have to challenge you. Hello, Carl. I just called to alert you to this new contract we've got.
It's one thing stepping up our schedule.
Pete, go ahead and just say it.
No, as a matter of fact, I just had Pete up here, and he seems to think that for a short time, the contract only runs 3 months, that he can handle the job.
Well, if we're prepared to lower our inspection standards, I think I could get by, too.
Well, I don't see why you should have to do that. If Pete can cut his share of the mustard, I don't know why you can't.
Well, it's possible, sir, but
it depends on a lot of things. I mean, overtime, or whether you're going to have to hire an extra shift, or...
Why don't we have a conference on this afternoon, say about 3?
That's okay with me.
Good. And you can give a little more thought as to how you think you can do the job. Maybe Pete and Jim will have some ideas for you and you for them.
That sounds fine.
Good boy, Carl. That'll really help me out. See you at 3. Sit down, Jim. I don't have a great deal of time on this, but I wanted to let you know that the contract I talked to you about has come through. I just finished telling out Pete and Carl they're going to see what kind of job they think you can do on it. Now, what about you? You going to have any problems we should know about?
Well, that much work's going to be added to the regular schedule. Somebody's going to get it. It's up to them and the machine.
Well, suppose we can take care of that. What about the machines?
Depends on how fast you step up the schedule. Too fast, you're going to have a rush right now.
How much could we pick up without any serious trouble?
I wouldn't say. We're getting pretty close to maximum right now.
Well, look, why don't we say this? I call a meeting on 3. Now, you may be like Jim. We may not hold this contract at all, but, well, give it some thought. See you at 3. In dealing with an individual, Mr. Manning may give the impression he is consulting him, when actually, he is telling him off to learn whether the person is for him or against him. He favors compromise to get the job done, but he retains full control of the decision-making process.
I warned you, Harold, from the very beginning that I might not go along with this new contract. And unless I hear some strong reasons to the contrary, I'm not likely to change.
You know the way I feel about these things, Jim. I could easily make this decision myself, but I'm willing to go along with the majority if you feel. I hope you will, too.
That's one thing about me, Harold. I think you know
very well. I may fight you up and down the line. Once the decision is made, that's it. I'll work as hard as the next guy to make it come out right.
That's all I ask. Now, gentlemen, this doctor won't take too much of your time. You see, I spoke to Pete about this new contract, and he came up with some ideas that I think might be very valuable. I'd like to get your thinking on it. Pete, what have you thought about it?
Well, my first reaction to the new contract was negative. Quite possibly like yours, Jim. But then I began to think about it, and I figured it would be more money for our people on the holidays. As Al said, it would be a bit of a cushion for the company. And since it's only for a short while, 3 months.
But you're talking about stepping up production, Pete. That's going to be rough on morale and machines.
Well, I know it isn't going to be easy, but I think we should do it. Maybe we shouldn't turn this down while looking at every angle.
What about your men? Aren't they afraid of setting new standards? You know, once you're working this fast, they're going to think you're expected to do all the time.
Well, now, no, that is not going to be a problem. Because the company has made it a practice not to set new production standards during any of these special rush projects.
And as far as the machines go, Jim, you've been wanting new machines, right? I think now you can get them with no strength. And I'm sure the company would be willing to put out a couple of extra loaders in your department, Carl, and move everybody out. Well, that'll help. I think we all agree it would be a mistake to lower our standards.
Well, that just leaves you, Jim. What do you think? What do you say?
Well, I haven't changed my position any. But if that's the way all of you feel about it, I'll do what I can to help.
Thank you, Jim.
Now, I think if we really get behind Harold on this, we can do a bang-up job.
Mr. Manning's way of selling his decisions is through individual influence and group pressures. Other executives who use this style take a different approach. More openly reporting their decisions, the way in which they arrive at these decisions, and the benefits to those who will carry them out.
Gentlemen, I know the holidays is 2 months away. Many of our employees have considerable interest in earning a little extra income. This is one of the reasons which led me to take a new contract with General Robinson. This contract will not only enable us to keep a full production schedule for all our employees, will also be considerable overtime work. If I do make the decision myself, it's especially important that I have to support my people. But with the end justified means. And will I keep that support over the long run? Maybe Mr. Connors, my last boss's style of leadership, is another way of providing direction and getting support. What would he have done?
The purpose of this meeting, as you know, is to explore the advantages and disadvantages of this contract. Now, I sent each of you a summary of the most important points in the areas that concern you. Now, before I decide on this contract, I'm going to need as much input from you as possible.
Well, what do you want to do? You know what you're going up against as well as it's not better than we do, right?
I'm thinking of accepting this contract for several reasons. The first is the company needs it. If the economy should take a dip, we'd be in a better position to withstand the shock. But I'm wondering, if I do accept it, how you men are going to feel about it. It'll mean stepping up your schedule for about 12 weeks.
Just long enough to develop some fancy ulcers.
But what?
What about quality control?
You certainly don't expect us to lower our specs, do you?
What about the equipment? Machines wear out a lot faster under stress.
Is there no money in the contract to cover that?
Now, hold on. Just one shot at a time. Now, I understand you. You'd like a little more money for your man yourself, right?
All right.
But the job could be done. And you're suggesting, Carl, that I revise our specifications to allow for less severe testing, right?
Well, Mark, we can figure a way that no one department suffers. I'll go along with you.
Now, I see. And Jim, you're going to suggest by the time 12 weeks are up, we need some new machines, right?
That's right. You've got to think it through. Even though the men know that Mr. Connors will make the final decision himself, they feel that they can influence that decision. They know he values their information and advice, that he is interested in the people who work for him and how his eventual decision will affect them. He has created an atmosphere where objections can be voiced, an environment of mutual trust where the men contribute freely.
Now, does anyone have any other ideas?
Well, I always figured the best place to draw people from are the company right here now.
Where?
Carl's department. It's easy to teach a man to be an inspector and an operator, and then allow the inspector to do a practical and operator's job and pick up something extra, though.
I see. It makes sense.
Well, that's fine.
But where do I get the new inspectors?
The same place, from the ranks of the company.
We can put on two or three new loaders and bring those other people up to better paying jobs.
Yeah. I can do that.
But we want them to understand that it was only temporary and that any overtime would have to be held down to the minimum to make the contract worthwhile. Now, are there any other advantages or disadvantages to this contract, or any problems that might come up that we've overlooked?
Can't think of any offhand.
No. What about the men?
Well, I think they'd go along with it if we assured them no new production rates set during this period. But if I do it right away, get their cooperation. Be sure we have it at the beginning.
Fine. I'll take care. Now, just one other thing. What do you think would be a fair and reasonable salary increase to yourself during this period?
Whatever you think.
Well, suppose I throw away some time on a straight hourly basis.
Fair enough. I'm 5 hours. I thought I would have.
Well, you are executive. Remember me now, but I forget.
By consulting his men, Mr. Connor seems to have created a high level of participation, a healthy climate, and a two-way flow of information. The decision has the support of the group, and control is consistent with the realities of the situation. Realities which always limit a man's choice of leadership style.
Now, I'll need all the information and ideas you need to give me so I'll have a clear picture of what this contract will mean to our company and our employees. Now, I'm not asking you to make a decision. I'll make it myself. I'll take that responsibility. But I do want you thinking on all the aspects of this proposal, and I want your reaction to my thoughts.
Well, I guess I have to consider several things. The kind of thoughts that we have. Kind of one. The pressures of time. What I can expect from the group. Even my own habits and inclinations.
But now, what should Jim do? Should he tell the group of his decision, like Mr. Alton? Should he decide himself and then try to sell his decision, pointing out how his subordinates and colleagues will benefit? Maybe he should consult his associates, test his ideas on them, and get their views before making his decision. Or should he join the group, contributing his ideas but giving equal weight to everyone else's as well? This, then, is Jim Hewitt, a man about to give leadership to his company. Which style should he choose? Which will develop the best climate in his organization? Which will provide the best balance between effective control and the meaningful involvement of his people? Which is best suited to the character of his group, to his own habits and inclinations? To the aims of his company, to the ever-changing conditions of the moment. Which will help his people perform at their best?
Years ago, I was in a school program with a professional. You know what a professional is? That's a fellow who really knows what he's doing. And every time that we had a film set up and they darkened the room, he could do it by the numbers. He'd watch the instructor go to the light switch. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. He could be asleep just about that fast. He was a real pro in action. I've always appreciated watching professionals in action. Of course, my dad said, son, it takes one to know one. So I've slept a little bit through a few films myself. Well, I think you, from a business standpoint, you saw four styles. Let's just very briefly look at those in the order now that we had them reviewed for us at the end of the film. The first one was the teller. Very strong personality. Has the conferences to communicate his ideas. He's not looking for input. He wants to communicate one way. That's a one-way communication. The leader tells, and the followers are expected to obey. They may be able to say a little bit from time to time, but the expectation is already established that the leader tells and the followers obey. Doesn't want feedback. Of course, that makes the person solely responsible, whether they succeed or fail. Maintains control throughout. Not if that person would not be willing to allow a point in which they were out of control if they could avoid it. And they usually can avoid it. They make up their own mind. Sometimes they'll do it ahead of time. Most of the time I would say that they do. Now there's something that didn't show up in the film that other research has indicated to me. And that is the last point under tells. That person is really not open to changing their mind. That would then call the followers, cause them to say, he doesn't listen. It doesn't matter what I say. The decision's already been made. Now, there are times when we need the telling style of leadership. I think that's now we're getting around to answering your question. Let's very briefly mention a few times that you can think of where we probably need someone as an authority, meaning who's very professional and competent in the area to tell people, and that the people on the other end need to be listening and to do it, basically, to tell and then obey. What are some circumstances you think that would be legitimate for this style? Yes. Yeah, now biblically, if you're just helping someone get started in their own life to grow, do they understand what quiet time is? You have to tell them. Show them in the Bible and then demonstrate it and then help them to get it done. Now, that's really telling. They don't know a good pattern for memorizing Scripture. In other words, the basics of helping someone get started tend to be more directive in nature.
Obviously, in a military situation.
Okay. Again, you think of some application to us now, spiritually, as an organization. I'm sorry?
Group discussion on a heart attack.
Group discussion on a heart attack.
You know, what should be done? I mean, I'm in reference to the doctor being an authority.
Yeah, okay. Now, we've had Bob Ridley come out and do some medical work, and I recall that none of the men that were checked medically really discuss that with him to say, no, my heart's really good, you know, when it's not doing all that well. There are authorities, so someone who's truly professional, okay, and any other instance you might think of. Experience. Not knowledge, yes, but also experience. If you've done the thing a number of times, have you ever been in a group when there's a new thing comes up and the leader says, is there anyone here who's ever done that? And some guy says, yeah, I've done it. Boy, immediately, you know, we get him to show the rest of the people how to do it. An experience factor.
When we're working with people who are working with other people, perhaps it's more important to get group participation than being less authoritative.
Do you agree with that? Working with people who are working with other people.
Just an example. I'm just trying to think of that. Let's say there's a situation where you have your infamous work days, and that's an example where you have a group situation. Now, would that apply in that situation where we are having a work day that's all been going now? That's a situation where it requires group participation, group support, yet sometimes the decisions have come down. We need to do a work day.
Did you hear the question? What's your response to that?
Sorry, I know in the campus situation, you know, where there is a group situation as you described, like a work day where everyone needs to be participate, and there's a situation comes down where it's sort of, we're going to have a work day, let's all get into it. And that's a situation. How do you, where is the balance on that?
It's a good parallel to the film, too.
Yeah.
Because in other words, the leader has been given a decision that's not negotiable, and now he's trying to figure out how to get the involvement of the people that he's got.
Suppose you're in an authoritarian system, and the leader, whoever the upper echelon leader, makes the decision and communicates then to the middle managers, we will do so-and-so. Then the middle manager schedule the day and simply tell you what to do. Now, that system in that circumstance is designed to tell and obey. That would be an authoritarian view. However, I think if you looked at the initial decision as to what's needed, if the top echelon or middle leaders even were working more of a participative concept, more of a consultative viewpoint as was described in the film, you may want to analyze what alternatives there were. What are the circumstances to be brought to bear? And if everybody understands and has an input in the beginning, then when it comes out, it doesn't have the ring or the feel of being dictatorial, because you had an input. Do we really need a work day? And if so, how many hours is it going to take? and who's going to take care of the supplies, who's going to take care of the elbow grease and that kind of thing. You can take what looks like an authoritarian situation and go back to the initial establishment of whether to do it or not, what are the circumstances involved, and make that participative. It doesn't have to come out every time, not all the way through the circuit.
Sometimes you have to secure
time with the doctor. Time. Yeah. Boy, that's one critical one, isn't it? If you have a short time, there's no opportunity to discuss the matter. Someone has to make a decision, and the followers have to follow it through. Emergencies, for example. Short time, yes, but emergencies. Who do you get a chance to vote in an emergency? There's not time. Once my wife and I were having, don't let me forget, I want to come back to yours. My wife and I were having lunch on a snack bar at Maxwell Air Force Base, and my wife said, "Honey, something's wrong with that man over there." And I looked over, he was holding the table, his face was just blood red. I'd never seen a man's face that red. And about that time he keeled over on the table. I said, "I think he's choking." And people walked by him and just looked at him, thought he was taking a nap or something. So I jumped up, ran over there. I knew it wouldn't do any good to slap him on the back, but I did it anyway. I slapped him on the back. Sure enough, didn't do any good. He was a pretty good-sized fellow. And I'm thinking, we've got to save this man's life. He literally is choking. I tried to talk to him, and he couldn't say anything. So the first two men who walked by were officers senior to me. There was a colonel and another major. I didn't ask permission. I looked at those two men. I said, "This man is choking to death. We have to save his life. You, get around in front of him and catch his head. We're going to turn him upside down. You, come around here by me. Come on, move." So he moved around there, and I put a shoulder up under a thigh. I said, "Put a shoulder under his thigh. You catch his head. Turn him upside down. Do it." And everybody moved, and I whopped him in the diaphragm and pulled hard. He breathed. And we saved his life. Those men never argue with me. We sat him down. He's breathing. His eyes are bloodshot. He's barely breathing. He's holding on the table. I said, "I think he's going to make it now. Thanks a lot." And they moved on. Then that man was the colonel. When's the last time I said, "Hey, you, move and do that"? That's the only time in my 20 years experience that I can recall that ever occurring. But you see, that was an emergency. There was no time to discuss it. And they could tell from the tone of my voice that I knew what to do. I had seen it demonstrated, even though I'd never done it. And I did know what to do. I had a very concrete plan. And there was no argument about it. There wasn't any discussion. I dominated the situation and took total control. However, my own heart was not to dominate those two men's lives and to control them. All I wanted to do was save this other guy's. See, there's an attitude difference in there. Time, if it's a short time period, which is what we have, that means I got to press on here a little faster. You thought I was from Maine all this time. Didn't you think I was from Maine? I mean, no, I'm from the main part of Florida. But even us slow-talking country boys, when that clock gets to praying on us, we speed up the rhythm just a little bit. That's an intimidation factor. But the idea that circumstances and time can be to help you determine that. Now, I was on to hear your viewpoint before we get off.
I was thinking of in the marriage relationship where it was a matter of the husband protecting the wife.
Yes.
You have to say it in a very strong fashion. Hmm.
Physical safety.
I don't want you to do this, or it would be unsafe, or don't do this.
Yeah.
It's a matter of protection.
And if you know what to do for physical safety, that's not a voting issue either, as far as I'm concerned. So there are times if the person is unskillful and you have to help them gain the skill. If they're novices and you have to get them, and you have to instruct them. You have to tell them what to do. And I prefer show and tell. You tell them, but demonstrate it to them.
Well,
yes,
sir. You've said a program quite a number of times, and I can see you float back and forth in these styles, because when you start to group out, you're telling.
That's right.
Outline of what's required of them first and say, "This is it. If you don't do it, you don't pass the course." And then you go into a different style as you get involved with them as the course develops.
And then, ultimately, if we started, it would be a vertical line, wouldn't it, to telling. But as they become more competent, they give more inputs. And then in book three, they start leading, don't they? Mm-hmm. Then it looks more horizontal.
Paul refers to the nursing mother, the encouraging father, and then the brother.
There you go. Very beautifully stated. And I think the ministry itself should start. You just about have to start with some authority position. The Bible is authoritarian now. If the Bible says it, that's not what I'm talking about. If you're going to hang tight with what the Bible says, then I salute you. Meaning, the Bible is authoritarian, authoritative, and controlling, and dominating, and directive. And I rejoice with that. That's the way it is with God's Word, but that's God. See? As the maker, the creator, the controller, and the ruler of this universe, and that's all I have in my heart is yes, sir, to that. But that's the biblical base. Now, as we relate to people, and in our relationship of a job accomplishment, organizationally, within the Navigators, I think that the concept of one person dominating another person's life and wanting to control it's out of order. However, I may have to start with more of an authority position, and then hopefully, prayerfully, move that until we're co-laboring. I've seen the time that even though you give the fellow an assignment, he's literally co-laboring with you in his mind, by the way it's functions, he is still subordinate. When I say subordinate, I mean controlled by. So, there are times when we would need an authority view. Yes, ma'am.
And I think early on like that, there are a lot of people who don't feel comfortable unless they're told. They don't know how to do something, and they need to be told that so that they can feel that they're...
I agree. I agree with that. I think that the wisdom is how to move the relationship from a vertical relationship up to becoming a co-laborer in the Lord. And I may be a co-laborer spiritually in ministry and still have a subjective leadership. In other words, I choose to subject myself to a leader and I can take that role even though I may be a co-laborer spiritually. It may be that we're both doing the same job and we turn out to be peers. But there are a lot of hidden attitudes in this leadership business. Yes, sir. Yeah, well, of course, I would say we're kind of playing on words. If he's able to use it, then my observation would be that he has it. If he can't use it at all, then he probably doesn't have it, and he's not going to succeed very long as a authoritarian. Unless he uses coercion some other way, like fear, threats, or being fired. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I just want to know that a person has a strong personality more than the other.
Yeah, incidentally, personality is not a key determiner here. A person can have a very strong, dominant personality and a very forceful voice, very resonant and dominating in sound. And he may, in fact, be a pussycat. And he may be one of the strongest joining type people you ever saw when he gets in a group. Personality is not the key. However, to be successful as an authoritarian leader, you just about require some type of domination in personality. Dominating, he doesn't have to be loud. How else could you dominate? By knowledge? You can dominate by communication. You can even dominate by manipulation. You can dominate by threat. And you can threaten with a smile. See, well, I just know this. If you don't follow through with this, I'm probably going to fire you. I'm happy about it. See, I'm not upset.
It does sound very spiritual when we throw around the word submitting and telling. And you talked about the heavy price for authoritarian style. Is that also not a heavy price in a marriage relationship as well? Because this stuff sounds so spiritual. Some of the people are using an authoritarian style under the guise of spirituality. And I'm wondering, is that the same thing?
In my view, that it's involved. See, the concept of women being subject to men doesn't mean authoritarian domination of a man over a woman. Not in my mind it doesn't. It's a loving leadership. And she has a willing followership. Now, how do you get that set up? Well, I'm not sure I really know. You know, I'm still working on some of the things in there. But I am convinced that authoritarian domination in a marriage relationship is not what God means. That women need to have the right to... It's a responsibility for women to communicate to the husbands and tell them how they feel. It's... Then the husband's love, you see, we haven't got time to go into that, but I think the point is that it will affect all of our relationships. An authoritarian who wants to dominate other people's lives, you see, that's going to cause problems. Some of the things you miss. First off, you miss the input. So you may be tracking on an error situation. You may never know it until it fails. Nobody will tell you. Secondly, there may be a wiser way to do it. It might succeed, but not be the best. Third, you may be about to lose your followers and nobody tells you. That's how you get into a mutiny situation. The leader may not know it until the mutiny occurs because nobody's telling him. And the key is that it's one-way communication. The followers know they're not to communicate. You see, that's the dominating thing that controls, and it's one-way flow. It's not interactive. There's not open communication in it, and you lose all those advantages you could gain otherwise. Now, to be very successful at that, you have to be intelligent, have a fairly strong personality. It helps to have a wide experience in what you're doing. See, otherwise, there's going to be failures. You also squelch creativity. See, the person that you're telling what to do will only do what you told them to because of fear. If they go 1 ounce beyond that, or 1 inch beyond, they may get stepped on. Especially if it happens one time. To anybody in the organization, if they used initiative and the leader says, well, that's not what I told you to do. See, wow, that's cut off and you squelch creativity and you'll find you only have just a limited response. I also believe that the people in a voluntary organization such as the Navigators, most of the times that I've observed a very strong a dominator is that the ministry tends to be small. It's pretty hard to have a broad base because people on the periphery won't go with that. The highly creative person will tell you off feet are Zane because they know that you're going to squelch them out of their creativity and they're not willing to do that. Then there's a whole lot of people, a wide range, if we had another couple of hours to talk about characteristics of people who will not put up with authoritarian domination. So I'm saying it's a costly approach, but there are times when we need it. In the beginning, you got to tell them. If you have the experience and they don't, you have to show them. When it's an emergency, when there's a short time, and there's certain characteristics of certain jobs that kind of lend themselves to telling. I think one was pointed out. There's a work job, and we can't really vote on all this. It'd be, end up being a confusion. But that's, in other words, the type of the job itself may be involved. Let's move on. The seller, the last thing. They're not open to changing their viewpoint. After you've told them, they're very, very unresponsive to change. Now, the seller basically is a teller at heart. He makes up his mind. And he's not all that open to changing it. He would like for people to agree with him and to do it voluntarily. That's probably part of his makeup. He just kind of feels that way. Now, he might can do it by proper motivation. That's outward motivation, telling you the advantages of doing the thing he wants you to do. And if that doesn't work, he'll probably play one person against another, like you saw in the film. He'll pull one guy in and get him. Well, Joe can cut his. I don't see any reason why you can't do yours. See, that's a put down. There's the peer pressure involved in that. And then finally, the manipulation. See, those are some negative ends of it. However, I think a good teller should also be a motivator. So that's not negative to want to sell the point, even though you may be a dominator or an authoritarian. There may be a difference in attitude. An authoritarian may not want to dominate everybody's life. We've made that point. We're going to have to keep that issue kind of running in and out of our minds. But the seller would still maintain group control. He's in control. He will make the final decision. And once he's made it, it's probably not open to a lot of discussion from that point on. He's unlikely to change his mind, while the first man is very unlikely to change his mind. Now, the consultor is going to make the decision too. This is not resignation. The consultor, or consultative style, or another word is participative leadership, will then bring the people into the act early. He'll call a meeting, but what he wants to know, he wants to present information and have their responses. He wants to honestly hear from them. And they have the freedom to discuss. They have the freedom to tell how they're feeling. If they're in disagreement, they're free to tell that they disagree and why. There's group interaction. Now, this man is probably willing to change his viewpoint. He may come in there with a viewpoint and usually does. And that's quite legitimate. You've thought the problem over and you're going to get the group together, you're going to discuss it. You have a viewpoint, but you're subject to change your mind. Now, that the way to find out about that is to ask some of your followers. If you have a question, you might, if you got a relationship, good relationship with a follower, ask, are you willing to change your mind? If you're not, ask your, if you're married, ask your spouse. Am I willing to change my mind if you give me the right inputs? My son-in-law, I really admire that young man. The more I'm around him, the more I love him and admire him. His mind is really something. It functions. He has some kind of an analyzer. He has an ability to very quickly put information down, and he reaches a conclusion from it. And then he can make a very strong projected statement about the decision. But I've noticed that if I've got some other data to enter, I said, well, have you thought about this, that, and the other? Well, no, he hasn't. Well, let's discuss it. And we talk about it. He says, oh, yeah, I see that. And he changes his mind. I said, man, that's where it is in my standpoint. Now, this person would establish a permissive atmosphere so that people are encouraged to talk and to interact, not only with him but with one another. He might ask them to clarify. He'll ask more questions to get them to give their viewpoints. Takes longer now. This is time-consuming. But they know that they can influence the final decision. And the followers also know that the leader really is interested in them as people. That not only do they have input, he cares for them to the extent that he's willing to have the inputs. Now, everybody knows he'll make the final decision. There is, in this properly conducted, in my mind anyway, if this participative leadership style is used, there will be an openness to the point of consensus views. In other words, there will be, you'll get a feeling in the group that it's moving in a given direction. And by and large, in most cases, the consensus view does dominate and is frequently the one that's decided upon. But the leader does not have to take the consensus view, not even in participative. There's no indication in here that you have to vote at the end. That would be called a democratic organization. Like a club, you know, when a club and you bring up an idea, the motion's made and it's seconded and it's discussed, and then you call for a vote and it's the majority wins. That's not participative leadership. And participative leadership, the leader still is the responsible person and is responsible for the decision. He may, in fact, when I say he, I'm talking about she. This is a generic word. That the leader can, in fact, listen carefully and go against the consensus of the group. Now, what do you think the leader should do if he does that? Carefully explain in great detail exactly what you're basing it on. And I would suggest something like, well, I've listened carefully to all that you said, and if I've done it correctly, I might have even been making notes on the chalkboard, and I could go back and review the notes. However, I think that point 7 down here, in my own mind and heart, is a higher priority than the rest of them. I'm giving it a weighted attention, and I'm going to make my decision based upon that one. And here's how I made the decision. And then you tell them. And then you encourage them to continue to give you the support, to give you the inputs, to give you the information. Now, even if you do that, if it's a truly participative situation, the followers know that they still have an avenue to come to you. And if tomorrow they think of something additional, they know that they can come, you'll receive them, and that you'll sit down and listen to what the new thing they have to say. And if it's strong enough and important enough or a priority enough or whatever, then you're still willing to change your mind. You see, I'm not talking about straightforward biblical issues that the Bible's already declared. None of us should be open to change our mind on those. If the Bible says it, then that seals it. So I'm not talking about those issues. I'm talking about our relational issues and the things that we're trying to get done that follow through the objectives, the details of how to do some of the things perhaps that the Bible says. You see the distinction?
Question.
Yes, sir.
If that occurs, then the group participants pretty much have been convinced of that leader, that he was willing to listen to their ideas.
Yes, that's right.
Because that just doesn't come about all of a sudden to believe that once he hears their ideas,
yeah,
and then he says, well, I've heard all the things that you've said, but I'm going to go with this idea.
Yeah.
I can't foresee that happening unless he's done something to create in their minds that he's a willing listener.
I'm going to suggest that it's relational. You have to win confidence. A young man years ago, I worked for this individual. He he was my boss, and he said, "You know, Bill, I seem to feel that you don't have confidence in me." He said, "Do you?" And I says, "Now, the very truth of the matter is that I don't." And he was making that negative for me. And I said, "Wait a minute. Let me distinguish between two terms." I said, "One term is loyalty. I can choose to be loyal." I said, "Are you aware that I've been loyal to you? Do you remember the instances?" And I reviewed some instances that I took personal flack because I was loyal to him. I just didn't tell people about him. But I took the flack, the accusations and a lot of other stuff. I said, "Do you realize that was loyalty?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I can do that by an act of my will. I can choose to be loyal. You have to earn my confidence. I can't just decide to have confidence in you." "Oh, I would like to, and I may try, but have you seen the person you're around?" "Well, I'm not sure I've got confidence in that trooper. You know, well, you know, here and there I'm a little bit reluctant." But after you have, like you said, the first time out of the chute, that's going to be touch and go. I'm not sure you can make this go on day one. It's going to take, unless you've already got the relationship, if the people know that you're that kind of person, and now you're put in the leadership role, and you already have their confidence, then you can make it go. But you're going to have to prove to them that you're open to changing your mind. And one of the best statements that I can offer to you is to say, "I've considered what you had to say, and I've changed my mind." Then you smile at him. Let him reinforce for him that you've changed your mind willingly. You could say, "I've changed my mind." Well, there's some communication that goes into this. Okay, the consults, in my opinion, is probably one of the most effective long-range styles that I know of for leadership. I think that we can operate in that. It gives us a much broader base to exercise our love, to still be in control, from the standpoint of control, meaning to still be responsible. That's a better word, not control. To still be responsible for the final decision. And everybody knows that. And I think that way they know that they can give their inputs now or later or whenever, that you are open to listen. The advantages of that is people will show their creativity. They will give you ideas you've not thought about. If you're started on a wrong track, they'll help you. I went to Egypt. I went to the Middle East several years ago, and I'd studied, but I knew there was a lot about the Middle East that I didn't know. So the man who's acting as interpreter for me, I said, "Look, I know very little about the culture and the people, just a little bit I've read. Please, feel free to give me instruction on any point you want to. Tell me anything that would be helpful for me, because I want to know." Okay, he agreed to that. And I said, "And another thing, if I do make a mistake, please tell me. Don't let me make the same mistake twice." Is that good advice? Is that good counsel? Don't make the same mistake twice? My dad told me that when I was a kid. He said, "Son, you're going to make mistakes. Try not to. You think about them. Head them off. If you'll give some thought to it and don't react, thought as opposed to reaction, you can probably do fairly well. But you're going to make mistakes. Don't worry about them. Learn from them. And for goodness sakes, don't make the same dumb mistake twice." Yes, sir. I mean, you know, that's good sense. Now, if you've got a participative group, they will head you off and help you prevent the error. You believe that? And if you make a mistake, what do you think they'll do? They'll help you get over that. They may go to help you solve it. They may, in fact, take care of it themselves, because you will be encouraging them to exercise greater initiative. You think that system would work in the U.S. military? More of a participative leadership? Not for everything. Now, the regulations are clear. You got to follow through on those. They're already dictated. It might surprise you that I think it works very well in selected situations in the military. When I was in Germany, I was Armament Electronics Maintenance Chief for the 36th Fighter Wing. I had 285 men, a small group of officers, and about 20 or 25 really top-ranking NCOs. And the NCOs really knew what they were doing. I'm not sure about the rest of us who were in the officer corps. But those NCOs really knew. And I tried to recruit those men to help me. I instituted what I called management by exception, that I made some assumptions that these men were trained and they were motivated, they had initiative, and they were not only willing, but they knew how to do a good job and were willing to do it. and that I viewed my job as to serve and help them? Does that sound militarish to you? It didn't sound altogether military, did it? I said, now, I don't want anybody in this wing to chew you out or get on your case. They get on my case. And then you and I will have our interaction. But whatever rank I have is the same one I'm giving you. In other words, you can take initiative up to the point that I can follow through with it. And I said, I told them the same things. Don't let me make mistakes. And I selected a handful of them. One particular chief master sergeant was old enough to have been my dad at the time. And that guy was probably as wise a man as I knew in the military. Didn't matter what his rank was. And I asked him to be my personal advisor. I said, I'd like to hold you accountable to help prevent me from making mistakes. And if I've made one, bail me out. And tell me where I made it and help me not to make it again. I said, if anything's happening in this whole organization, I need to know. If you want to tell it to me on any standpoint at all, when you shut that door, it's man to man in here. Then I had my key leaders, when we had our meeting, we talked about the objectives, and we had those written down. They were handed down by command. Now, how are we going to achieve them? We had great openness. Great openness, and the men were given the inputs on how this ought to be done. And once we made a decision, they knew they could come back and talk about it. So I'm saying that you can do this even in an authoritarian situation. And you know what? Performance-wise, we had a slight dip in the curve, in the maintenance performance curve, and then that thing shot up like I couldn't believe. Those men, even two stripers, were taking responsibilities. They were figuring out creative ways to do things, and I was standing with them as far as I could, and they were taking care of their own problems. I only heard about the problems they couldn't take care of. They were coming to me for help, and I was serving them. And I'm just so thankful because that saved my neck. Otherwise, we couldn't have succeeded. We were about 50% manned. And the way they did it was that they took the creative viewpoint. Even one staff sergeant made a piece of equipment to help shorten and improve a process of checking. I was so impressed with it, I asked him to write that up and send it in the U.S. Air Force inventory as an item called the Smith Tester, named after Sergeant Smith. I'm saying that this man was creative. He had full freedom to use his creativity, and I wasn't about to squelch it. Now, there were certain things that we did were dictated by regulation and technical orders, and we had to follow those to the letter. So you see, even in the process, there are certain circumstances that you can do it and some that you can't, but I think the attitude is, let's treat people like people. Now, let's treat other Christian brothers and sisters like they're a child of God. That they are a joint heir with Jesus Christ. It doesn't matter how old or how young or what color or how smart or what or how strong he is or she. You see, we're joint heirs with Jesus. And I might even ask the question, how dare you dominate the life and attitude and internal spirit, not the Holy Spirit, but your own personal responses? How dare you do that? I might could ask that question. If you look at it from the standpoint that this is a child of God and the same price was paid for their soul was paid for my soul, that's kind of heavy thinking. Well, the last case was the join. That's where you become one of the group. Now, depending on which end of this you want to look at, the leader may still reserve the option to make the decision. It also lends itself very closely to the democratic view, where you can vote and let the vote determine. You probably could go either way and still be in the joining process. But here, the leader's viewpoint doesn't have any more weight than the followers. Is that a viable system? Will that work? You've heard the term, we must have a strong leader. Heard the statement. Yeah, and what are the conditions of the people? For sake of time, let me mention. You could come up with them if we spend a little more time on it. One, they have to be well qualified in the thing that they are about. They need to be properly trained and properly educated. They need to be motivated, self-motivated. They need to have initiative to proceed with it. And they need to have some honesty and integrity. So you don't have to check behind them for everything. Self-motivators. Honest, high integrity, guys that are trained to know what to do, then I think you can expect that group to do it. Does that sound reasonable to you? That you could expect a group like that to do it. All they need to know is what the objectives are. And if you got a detailed situation, then they need to know some of the details to see that through. Can you see the advantage of that? Now, I'll give you one case that I nearly failed. I mentioned that I'd been down at Cape Canaveral, and one of the jobs I had while I was there was I was, quote, middle manager, end quote, for a group of civilians that we had recruited with an open money bag. We recruited them by offering them unbelievable salaries. And they were masters of very small pieces of information. And it took a big bunch of them to get all this little these pieces of information together. And many of them were prima donnas. I mean, they had their PhDs and they had learned more and more about less and less, you see. So they really stood out that they were really up there. And these guys weren't open to be told anything, the best I could tell. And my predecessor, the officer before me that had that responsibility, went in there and read them the riot act. This is what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to do it. He gave them a military briefing, and he left, and they gave him the old rash. You know, they weren't about to do that. They didn't say anything. They didn't give the verbal sound. They just didn't do it. And he failed. And he got fired. And I'm the replacement. That didn't look too encouraging. You know, it's sort of like, hell, Lord, what in the world am I going to do with these bunch of prima donnas? And then I found one country boy in the crew who could talk the heavenly language. You know, we had our interaction, and I said, look, Sid, man, I'm coming in here, and that other trooper blew it out the side. I don't want to sink the ship at all, much less in the harbor, you know. Help me not to do that. Give me some clues. He said, well, Bill, you know, these guys, and he laid them out to what they were like. He says, you can't really tell them. And I said, describe them in more detail than he did, and it ended up in my mind. I said, oh, they're extremely well-educated. We're motivating them with an open money bag. I mean, who around here makes that much money? They do know what it is that they're doing in their own field, and we've given them a written document of what the requirements were, what the technical requirements are. What I like to do is just make sure that they've all got that information and turn them loose and say, now, here I am. If you come up on a problem, let me know about it. Otherwise, I'm going to assume that you know what to do and you're doing it. And I'm going to trust you. And that worked like a charm. And I got a good effectiveness report and didn't get fired. I think if I'd have used any other style with them, I'd have failed. But you see, the point that you made, they match those things that you had in mind. Otherwise, I'm not sure you can use that. I don't know how viable it is. That's anarchy. You know, if you get a bunch of people running, they don't know what they're doing, you just let them run around. That's, you know, what is that? Sheer confusion. But that's not what I'm suggesting with that. There are some times. Well, we've seen those four styles. Now, there is probably a bureaucratic leader that doesn't fit this. That's ruled by policy. And I'm sorry to say, but one of the symptoms of a maturing organization is that it tends to become bureaucratic. We tend to develop policies and rules and regulations, and the policies become law. I don't mean the policies were written as guides, and they end up being law. When the organization highly matures, then the bureaucratic leader doesn't have to justify anything. He just finds out what the policy said, do, and he uses the policy as the whip. And it doesn't really match all of these. He may be one or more of these other styles at different times, but his mind is he's allowing the bureaucracy to do it. Then there's a style of leader that we might call a charismatic leader. I don't mean a spiritually charismatic from speaking in tongues and so forth. I'm talking about just a magnetic personality. Can you think of one of our presidents in the last 50 years who was kind of charismatic?
Eisenhower.
Perhaps. Franklin D. Roosevelt. I would say perhaps with him. Anybody else? John Kennedy, perhaps. What about Lyndon Johnson? Not that charismatic, was he? I mean, really, Lyndon Johnson was not all that charismatic. You just really weren't drawn up, even though he spoke, and I'm sorry to say, he spoke the heavenly language too. But, you know, there were some other factors in there. So there's a charismatic leader who doesn't fit any of, in other words, there's no way to describe it because it's an unusual factor. He's able to get people to go with him just because of who he is. And when you try to analyze it, you can't put your finger on it that closely. But I think the four styles we talked about here, the one I would propose for most situations would probably be the participative or consultative style. Now, we've talked about the instances that we do need to use a more authoritarian view because of time and emergency. If they don't know how to do it, you have to tell them how to do it. You have to show them how to do it. Those things, to me, are legitimate uses of the authoritarian style. Then there's the seller, who's really an authoritative, is really authoritative at heart, but tends toward wanting to get people to agree to do it. Sometime that fellow fakes himself out. He feels he's really participative. And you know how to find out? If you wonder what style of leader you are, how are you going to find out? Yeah, and I submit that the leader is probably one of the poorest people for you to ask your own self. You need to think about it and to come up with your own viewpoint, but it's not that reliable. The people who are reliable to tell you are those who follow. He said the followers can tell you. If you're a leader and you have people who are following you, if you did nothing but show them these, let them read through it and say, which one do you think I predominantly am? And you may want a group discussion, you may not. You may just let them tell you a person one at a time or let them put you on a sealed sheet of paper, ever how you want to do it. See, if you really are a dominator, they're not going to tell you that. If they have fear. If they're angry and resentful, they'll tell you. Well, I mean, that's the only person who can really tell. You get the most honest answer that way. And you suppose you say, I really am a participative leader, or I'm a joiner, or I'm a seller. If you really say that, see, you might honestly believe it. But if they think you're some other style, then that's the one you're coming across as. That's what you would be trying to find out.
What's the disadvantage, though, for example, of this joiner, this join approach? When you ask for a vote among people, let's say you're making policies for, let's say this training program, you're making policies, and you have five people, and you're thinking, what are your objectives, and you go, well, can we have a vote? And two people say this, and two people say this. Should you ask for things like votes, or is it more biblical to say, well, I appreciate all this, and I'll make a decision as a leader?
Well, I guess deep down, I find one or two cases in which they cast lots, but that wasn't a vote. Did you pick up that I never one time in here suggested that the leader should resign? I carefully said the leader should not resign. If you call for a pure democratic vote and you're going to follow what the majority vote, then I'm not sure that you have a leadership situation. It's a democratic situation. So, you know, I've been careful to say that the leader doesn't resign. He may get the seat. I'd like to know how you feel, but if he's going to say that, he needs to have it understood ahead of time. He's still going to make the decision. You open yourself up pretty heavily on that one. The only time I would be willing to do that, I think, would be as if I honestly needed to know how they felt, or if it didn't have a significance in my own mind or heart, and I'd just like to know how you feel, and it doesn't seem to me to have that big of a case, and I'd say, okay, well, let's vote on this one. I can, by my attitude, I can give a democratic situation and still maintain the option that I'm the leader. And more than that, even if I do it in that situation, I need everybody to understand, if you vote and I go along with the vote, I'm still responsible because I am the leader and I have to give account for it. You see, those issues we laid early, they've got to carry throughout. Yes, sir.
Yeah, leadership style is so connected with our very innate personalities. Can you give us any suggestions on how to change from one style to another?
Yes, I really can. I've got some concrete ideas. One thing is that the men shot down up here by this clock. Do I need to answer that question? Do we need to stop?
We don't need to stop.
Okay, I can give you some suggestions. Most of the time, very few people that I know in our organization are trying to come away from the join. So I think we can probably put that joining process aside and say we're looking at the other three. Now, if you wanted to make some changes from the dominating and the selling to become more participative, yes, you can plan some of that to occur. One is that you can explain in the process how you intend for the thing to happen. In other words, you want to recruit their support. You want to hear their viewpoints. And I think make the statement early that you are willing to change your mind.
You have your own views, but you're open to change. Now, you're going to have to prove that to over a period of time that you really are willing to change. Secondly, that the things that are given that you don't have any control over, and in the Navigators, it's the Great Commission. There are a few other things, but not a lot of other things that I've found. Then you've got an objective here to help achieve the big goal you're shooting at. Now, with that objective, I would suggest that you get the people to give their inputs early. It may be that they need to come up with the objectives. Now, what you want to do is improve the whatever. Here at the Glen, you want to, if you could just say our objective today is to improve, and you can write it up there, improve something, the housekeeping functions. How can we do that? See, then you'd open the floor really for discussion. Well, we can do this and that and the other, and the people start interacting, and you can ask for questions, but see, you'll do it by questions. How can we do it? Well, what do you think of the advantages of that? Does someone have a contributing viewpoint or another viewpoint? In other words, you get them to ask questions. Instead of saying, boy, if you do that, you'll fail, you might ask a question. Instead of making a pronouncement, you ask more questions. Well, what do you think might be the consequences if this piece does so-and-so? Then, see, they're talking about the consequences. And then you can pick up with the flow. Then you'll summarize. Well, it seems to me that I'm hearing you say, and then you write down what you heard them say. You see, you act as a guide, an interpreter, a summarizer. You ask lots of questions. And then you get your nonverbal to be reinforcing for that. You know what I mean by reinforcing? That you don't look dominating. Well, I want to hear your viewpoint. Who, mine? I mean, I don't have a viewpoint. You see what I'm saying? Now, then you can practice, and if you got a guy that really cares for you in the group, and among the followers, solicit his help. Say, look, I want to move more toward this other thing, and help me to get there. Let me know how I'm doing. Then after it's over, you got to listen with the objective. Then when he tells you a thing, press him a little bit. Tell him, well, how do you think I can do that? He says, well, don't appear quite so threatening. Well, you don't understand that. You have to say, well, what can I say, do, or act, or whatever to appear less threatening? See? You see the point? And that's not going to happen overnight. You probably need to work at that. Now, if you're an authoritarian dominator by nature, meaning that's who you are inside, then you may have to look at it in a broader base than just on the job and other relationships with friends, perhaps a husband-wife relationship. Get your spouse to help you with that. They're the best evaluator and suggester that I know. And again, you got to be willing to listen with the objective to change. So, of course, you got to pray about this. Ask God to show you. Search it out in the Scripture so you're convinced that even though the Gentiles lord it over one another, it's not to be that way with you. And not lording it over anyone, but as examples to the flock. You lead by love and influence. And God's given you the position. You have the authority. I mean, it's there, and that's recognized because that's your position. But your attitude doesn't have to be one of control. Okay, yes, sir.
I've got a two-part question. One is, as you analyze the leadership style that Jesus demonstrated in his ministry, where would you put him here? And the other is, what leaders from Scripture would you say primarily use this consulting type of leadership?
Okay. I'm going to have to say that I'm not going to be able to tell that clearly. You know, I told you at the outset, as far as styles, there wasn't but one that I found the Bible described. And that was the one that was not permitted. Now, as I see Jesus, primarily I think that he was telling and explaining. He was show and tell. But I think that throughout, even the night before he died, what was his statement to the disciples, to the apostles? Have I been so long with you, and you still don't understand? I see that. I also recognize that Jesus is God, that the Holy Spirit had not come into their lives. Now, I recognize Jesus did a lot of show and tell, but I think that we made that point that that's totally legitimate. I don't see how you can start a ministry without show and tell. I think if you call a group together, listen, we want to study the Bible, how would you like to do it? Well, unless they know how to do some of the things, man, you're not going to get that off the ground. I think that's legitimate. Now, if you take Paul, when the Holy Spirit was in their lives, and he's out telling us about making disciples and multiplying them. I remember one time he told the Corinthians that he could tell them. He had the position of authority to tell them. He chose not to do that. He didn't exercise the leadership role as to be a dominator controller. Now, there were times he spoke very sharply. And you can speak sharply and honestly and still not have the desire to control another person's life. See, I think it's not so much the style as it is the heart attitude. We've already admitted that an authoritative style is permissible, so long as the heart is not one. You want God to control the life rather than you control the life. See, every one of us shall give account of himself to God, unless my leader told me something else. No, we put men to death over that at the war crimes trial, so put them in there for life. The leaders of the Nazi regime commanded these men to go out and kill Jews. And their defense at the trial was, my leader told me to do that. And what did the world say? Baloney. You knew that was wrong when you did it. That's what the world said in those trials. And I think God wants us to have this option to respond to him. And if somebody tries to take it away, you see, there's the line. Not that you lead with a position of authority. You have to tell when it's needed. So I would say that that's what I see. I also observed the apostles. Who led the apostles? Skip, you might help us here. Who led the apostles after Jesus ascended into heaven? Sure. And who was there, a single leader that did it all?
Well, Peter and Paul are the two prominent
ones in the book of Acts. Sure. And I think we can see those are two being prominent. They didn't look a lot alike to me in the book. There was a wide range of possibilities for them. And we didn't, even though we had the Bible, and that's very...